Well, good morning. It's great to see everybody here this morning. We have a number of guests, and we welcome you into our worship and hope that you are edified and uplifted. And as I look out, I see folks that have been traveling, have been away, and you're back with us. We missed you. And it's good to have you in our number this morning, and glad you are back safe and sound. If you have your own Bible, turn to John chapter 13, and we're going to be using that as a launching place for our study. Bless you. John chapter 13 this morning, and hope you'll follow along with that passage in whatever verse you have. If you have a pew Bible, I think there's some in the front. Please pull that out. We're going to read about 17 verses to kind of launch where we want to go in talking about ministry this morning. Our mission statement is in our Family Matters, and you may have seen it on a and as you came in. And this is something that we have been working on. Bill alluded to this in his talks this morning at the table, both with the contribution and with the Lord's Supper, and the idea that we are focusing this month on ministry. And what we've been trying to do all year in the theme of restoring our focus is to get back to Acts chapter 2, to get back to Jerusalem church, to get back to what we see the early Christians focusing upon, the purpose that God had for them, and by way of implication and application, the purpose he has for you and I today to focus upon the things that he wants his people to be working on. So each month we have put forth a different area for us to give special attention to do. And this month of November, it has to do with ministry. And I thought there is no better topic to think about than to think about Jesus' model for ministry. And Jesus teaches us in his model for ministry how you and I can make a difference in ministering to the needs of other people. So let's look at John chapter 13 and read with me together the first 17 verses as we think about this occasion in the life of Christ. John chapter 13. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already been put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God, and that he was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, What I'm doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. And Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you will have no part with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not wash my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. But you are clean, but not all of you. For you know who would betray him, therefore he said, you are not all clean. So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he had sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Now, let's look at this text for a couple minutes, think about what we've read, and then we want to learn some things and make some applications. The setting of this ought to be obvious to most of us. It is on a Thursday when Judas has gone to find out what he would receive for betraying Jesus, and we find in other accounts that he is told by the religious leaders that he would receive 30 pieces of silver, which was basically the purchase price of a slave. So Judas had come to this supper already having in his heart that he was going to sell out the Lord. This is the time of the Passover feast. Other accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, tell of the institution of the Lord's Supper. It's not recorded here in John, but the supper had ended, and after the Lord's Supper, we see these events that we've just read taking place. Now, it is interesting when you think about what was on their minds. It says here in John 13 that Jesus knew that his hour had come. This is Thursday evening turning into Friday, where Jesus will be taken captive after his betrayal, tried illegally, and crucified on Friday. His hour had come. He realized that the Father had given into his hands all things, and that all things had come from God, and that he had come from the Father. And he knew that he was going back to the Father. And so Jesus did not enter into the crucifixion with some fatalistic kind of a view, or something that Jesus didn't know what was happening to him. Jesus came to the earth for this mission of dying for the sins of the world, and he knew that the time had come, and he knew that he was doing the will of God. Now, what was on the minds of the disciples? Well, we get a little bit of an idea here because it speaks about Judas, but it doesn't tell us everything. Because we read in other accounts what was going through their minds. It says in Luke chapter 22 and in verse 47 that a dispute arose among them about who would be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, can you imagine that? We know that they're getting a sense of what is going on because John 14 tells us their hearts were heavy. And they begin to get a sense that the clouds of opposition were forming and the religious leaders were going to do something drastic. They had a sense of foreboding and sorrow in their hearts. And yet, on the very eve of this occurrence, of the crucifixion of their Lord and Master, of the institution of the supper, and him telling them they would remember his death, there arose a dispute among the apostles on who was going to be the greatest. That is almost inconceivable, isn't it? But this Luke says, was exactly what was going through their minds when this was happening. So, what did Jesus do? Now, Clinton, I know what I'd probably done. I'd probably chewed him out. I'm just saying, my fleshly nature, I might have said, I'm going to give you guys a piece of my... You've been with me 3.5 years, and this is the best you can do? I'm ready to die for your sins, and you fellows are arguing about who's going to be the greatest? You don't get it. What's wrong with you guys? And I dare say a lot of us might have felt that. But that's not what Jesus did. Jesus, it says, rose to stoop. And we just read in the text, he didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. Now, there's a little bit of custom that's behind us that maybe we don't see in the text about washing their feet. It was a custom then, and a lot of you have known this in other studies, that when you come into someone's house, that is an act of hospitality, you wash feet. Now, we don't do that today. When someone comes to visit, we might say, can I get you something to drink? And that sort of thing. But then as they walked everywhere through the hot sands of Palestine with sandals, their feet were dusty and dirty, and they were tired. It was just a common act of courtesy to do that. Now, anybody that had any money at all had a household slave. In fact, they probably had several slaves that had been taken captive from other nations or whatever. And so these people were indentured servants, and the lowest of the low of servants was the slave that washed feet, as you can imagine. Not exactly your prime job of washing someone's dirty feet. And it would have been because the disciples were the ones that were in charge of getting the upper room and securing everything for the supper. We learned that from other accounts. And so it would have been their job to have secured a slave to have done this. And maybe since they got there and no slave was there, they would have done it themselves. Now, the graphic I showed you earlier is probably not right of them sitting at a table. The custom of that day and time would have been at a table that was just maybe a foot or less off of the floor, and having mats that they would lay on and recline. And you've seen pictures and Greek literature and so forth of people reclining around a table, resting their chin on their elbow or hand, and sitting there and eating with the other hand. And that's probably very similar to the kind of table they have been sitting at. So if you can picture this, and you got 13 people around a table like this and their feet are sticking out, then Dan, if you're right next to me, your face is going to be by my feet. And if I had washed my feet, that might not be a very pleasant thing. But they ate the whole supper and they went through that, and now they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. So what did Jesus do? No lecture, no condemnation, doesn't say a word. John 13, we just read, doesn't say a word. He just gets up and takes a towel and a basin of water and washes their feet. That's what he did. Now, what did it mean? Well, it meant this. Jesus is saying that we lead by serving. I'm your Lord and Master. I'm your leader. I've called you to follow me, but one of the great ways that we learn to lead other people is through serving other people. And throughout Jesus' ministry, that's what he did. That was his model. Jesus led by serving the needs of those that were following. Not only that, the road to greatness really comes through service. If you want to be great, Jesus said, become a servant. We tend to think of greatness as in other ways. But Jesus taught that model. In fact, it's kind of interesting in the business world today, there have been a number of books that have been written of servant leadership. And the model is beginning to change even in the business world of teaching the notion that if you want to be a leader in business, learn to be a servant of the people that are under you. Well, that's not anything new. Now, there's a lot of new books that have been written by Maxwell and other people about it, but that goes back to Jesus. Jesus taught the principle that the road to greatness is through service. And he's teaching that humility is a godlike virtue. That when we humble ourselves and we're willing to come and to do menial acts, we're willing to serve in ways that other people won't serve, that we're being more like God. We're following Jesus. We're emulating deity. That's what he's teaching us in this passage. Now, let's think for a few minutes about some application as we think about the kind of attitudes that we model when we follow Jesus and what we see in his life. I think one attitude, if we're going to be successful in service and make a difference, is a watchful attitude. To be aware, to be alert, to be vigilant, to be alert to opportunities. And we ever see Jesus doing this, and this is an example here in John 13, Jesus was alert to the fact that there had been no servant to wash feet. And Jesus saw this as a perfect opportunity to teach a spiritual lesson. And you see this throughout his life. If we are to have a make-a-difference mindset, if we are to model the ministry of Jesus, then we also must be alert. We must be aware of things that are going on. In 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 6, Paul said, "Therefore let us not sleep as others do, but let us be watchful and sober." And so success in ministry, to make a difference in ministry, we must watch and be alert and be sober. Secondly, we must learn to be obedient. Jesus, it says in John 6 and verse 38, came to do the Father's will. He said, "I didn't come to do my own will, but I came to do the will of him that sent me." Now, if Jesus, the Son of God, came to do the will of the Father and obey him, does it stand to reason that if we're followers of Christ, we need to be obedient? That we need to do his will? That we need to do what he said and follow what he said? And Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5 through 8 is a very familiar passage, but I have this from the J.B. Phillips translation, And Phillips translated this, let Christ himself be your example as to what your attitude should be. For he who had always been God by nature did not cling to his prerogatives as God's equal, but stripped himself of all privilege by consenting to be a slave by nature and being born as a mortal man. And having become man, he humbled himself by living a life of utter obedience, even to the extent of dying, and the death he died was the death of a common criminal. While that's not a literal word-for-word translation by Phillips, I think he certainly gives the essence of the thought and the meaning here that a make-a-difference mindset means that we need to be obedient. But then a third thing is to take the initiative. The idea of Jesus taking action, seeing what needed to be done and doing something about taking initiative. Bill read from Acts 10, I think it was, a few minutes ago, about Jesus went about doing good. Jesus was ever taking the initiative. He was ever looking for opportunities to serve others and minister to others. And he took the initiative to do things that other people wouldn't do, like in this example here. He took the first step. He healed the lame man and the blind man. He initiated the miraculous catch of fish. He was ever looking for opportunities to make a difference in the lives of his disciples and to teach them spiritual lessons. You know, sometimes you see people that just seem to have that attitude. They see things and we say to ourselves, why didn't I see that? Why didn't I think of that? And they jump in and do something that needs to be done. Well, here are people that have a mindset of taking the initiative. And we all need to work a little harder and looking for things that we can see that need to be done and then take the initiative to follow through and to get them done. And of course, Jesus was industrious. He was a hard worker. And this shouldn't surprise us about the idea of ministry. Ministry is hard work. It takes time and effort and energy to serve the needs of others. And I'll tell you what about ministry. Sometimes it's messy. Sometimes it's dirty. Sometimes it's smelly. Just like washing his feet. And there's some of us that have a hard time sometimes having a stomach for that kind of work. But God calls us to work hard and to be busy and to be tireless about what he was doing. And we see what he was doing. In fact, Bill mentioned in his table talk about Jesus beginning his ministry at age 12. And what was his life filled with for 3.5 years? Teaching and preaching and healing and helping and counseling and equipping and mentoring and answering questions. The Son of Man, he said, has nowhere to lay his head. Ever busy, ever on the go, all befoot. Not an air-conditioned automobile driving around or in a coach, but all befoot, walking up and down the shores of Palestine, working hard. He said, I must work the works of him that sent me. What is day, for the night is coming when no man can work. Of course, Jesus knew his time was limited. I think we forget that sometimes because we act as if we have unlimited time. Now, when you're young like these fellows up here on the front row, it's hard to think about that, of having limited time, because I'm just now getting old enough, since I've gotten over 40 a few years ago. Now, I tell you, you get past 60 and, you know, you start seeing people that you went to school with and you get a notice that they passed away. And you see people getting diseases and things happening. I was talking to our son Kenny the other day, and he's a runner. Kenny just turned 40. So that is a wake-up call when your kids get 40. You go, whoa, wait a minute. But he was running in a 5K race, and he placed ninth in this race. He was number one in the over 40 age group, and he ran a good race. Well, I was talking to him later, and he said that. I said, what'd your cross-country kids do? He said, well, we all ran a mile. And he said, we had a hard run yesterday, we just ran a mile. I said, what'd you do, Kenny? He said, I ran a 5:07. I said, that's pretty good for a 40-year-old guy. He said, yeah, but Dad, I can remember when I could go out and I could break 5 minutes and run down in the forest. I said, yeah, but you're 40. I said, wait till you get to be my age. He said, well, let me think. And if I only lose, and he figured out how many seconds he had lost in the next, I said, no, you're going to lose more seconds than that. It's called the law of diminishing returns the older you get. But that's just life. You get older. But you know what? Even the young are not guaranteed of tomorrow. We don't like to think of that. But the young die too. Emerson said, no one has learned anything about life until he's learned that every day is doomsday. And so we don't know who might walk out this building, whether 16 or 60, or older or younger, and not make it back next Sunday. We don't know. Our time is limited, and we must work the works of him that sent us while it's day. While we have life and opportunity, for there's a time coming when we're not able to work. And then the Lord wants us to be shrewd in the way that we involve ourselves in ministry. To be wise. I'm not going to take the time to do it this morning, but in Luke 16, you can read the parable of the unjust steward. That deserves an entire lesson by itself. But the point of that parable is that this man was shrewd. He dealt shrewdly. And Jesus uses him as an example, not of being dishonest, but an example of shrewdness, and says the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of life. And so use some sense, use some wisdom, be prudent, be shrewd in the way that you involve yourself in ministry. Have a perspective and be discerning as you involve yourself in ministry. And then to even serve beyond duty. You know, we live in an age where people say, it's not my job. Don't we? And please be advised, you know, I say things sometimes, I don't want people taking the wrong way. My dad was in the union for 33 years, so I'm not anti-union. But, you know, sometimes the mindset of, you know, that's not my job. You know, that's not my contract. Call this guy. He's in that union or this or that, you know. Well, you know what? In Christianity, I don't think that works. We're not in a union in Christianity. You know, but sometimes we have that mindset, it's not my job. Well, maybe it is your job if you see the need and you have the ability and the opportunity to do it and not think about, it's not, was it Jesus' job to wash feet? Well, not really. Did God send him this earth to wash feet? But if washing feet was necessary to teach an important lesson, then Jesus was willing to wash feet. And that needs to be our mindset. That whatever is necessary to get the job done. So Jesus say, likewise, when you have done all of those things which are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants, for we have done what is our duty to do. When I do everything that I can possibly humanly do, and I've done it all, when it's all said and done, I'm still an unprofitable servant. I'm not going to earn my salvation by doing these things. I've just done what I can do to make a difference. Jesus said, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. The extra mile, doing more than we're asked, doing more than required, doing more that's in our job description, so to speak, that we have that attitude that we're willing to do it. And then Jesus in John 13, we read, said, if you know these things, blessed are you if you what? Do them, thank you. Do them. Not blessed are you if you go here and can't preach a sermon on it. Not blessed are you if you're able to fill in all the blanks. Blessed are you if you do them. And that's our call. Let me just, because you got more blanks I can see. That's the only thing about doing blanks. See, if I didn't do that, I could just stop here and think, well, that was the lesson. But I'm just going to bullet these because we're going to talk about these tonight in our group here. There are three applications. There are your three applications. In my church family, in my physical family, and in my community. And I wanted you to think about, and those of you that are group leaders, if you have, I don't know what you got planned tonight, but if you got some time, take a few minutes and take the sermon notes and take the bulletin and just think about how we could minister this month and how we can apply these in our church family, in our homes, and in our communities. Now, I hope you all picked up a bulletin. If you didn't, grab one before you go out, because we have an article on the front page about being a minister and what that means. And then on the inside, I have 30 days and 30 ways to make a difference. Now, let me explain the way this works real quick, because I don't want anybody to think that I think that you've got to do all 30 of these to be a good Christian to go to heaven. These are suggestions. These, we used to call it in the old days, Pete, priming the pump. Now, young people don't know what it means. I've primed a pump before, but, you know, you pour a little, anyway, that's another story. To kind of help you get to thinking about other ideas. But I have this chart here, and today would be the third, right? Is that right? Okay, the third. All right, I thought it was. And so maybe you've already done a couple things. I did send an email on the first about this, if you got my email. All right, so maybe you've already done a couple things. If you haven't, that's okay. But look at this list and think about how can you serve. And this is just for you to kind of think about, and maybe you write in a little note or something that you did that day or you're going to do and check it off. And think about every day some way you can serve. Now, some of these, some of you can do, some of you can't do. Some one can do one thing and one another thing. We all have different talents, skills, and abilities. Go back to Bill's class on ministry and giftedness and finding your spiritual gift. If you went through that class, you should have some idea which of these 30 work good for you. And so some of them you might do more than once. Some of these you might be really good at, and you do 6 or 8 or 10 times. That's okay. You got that? So just think about how this month you can serve the needs of other people in these various areas. I see. I like what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing some of you already read these in circle and what you can do. I like it. This is good. Now, if you're in my group at the church building tonight, bring this back with you. Put in your Bible, bring it back with you. We're going to use this by way of application tonight, and we're going to think about this, how we can individually do some things, and then I got an idea for a group project that we can all pitch in and have a little part of something that I think is going to be very cool. Right here in our community, if I could throw a ball like statues, I could hit the place down here. Yeah. You can throw a ball, can't you? Just right down here at the shopping center. A place where we can make a difference to help people that are hurting in our community. You say, what's he talking about? Come back tonight. Now, if you're in another group, don't come back here to find out. I'll tell you the rest of you later. Okay, go to your group meeting tonight, wherever that is. All right? But if you're in this group, come here, and I'm going to talk about a way that we can make a big difference as Christians and serving the needs of other people. Ladies and gentlemen, Christianity is practical. It's not theoretical. It's not about Ken working up a fancy sermon and everybody coming and taking notes and saying amen and say, boy, I really like that. That was good. Well, I hope you liked it, and I hope it was good, and I hope it helped. But I hope it's something practical we can go out and put into our lives and that you and I can make a difference. Isn't that what God's called us to do? To be salt and to be light and to live in this world and to make a difference. And that's what we really want to focus on this month as we think about making a difference in serving and ministering the lives of other people. We close this morning, we sing a song of invitation and encouragement that Bill selected. And it's a song to get us maybe to think a little bit about where we are in our lives, our relationship to the Lord, and if we're where we need to be. And it may be that many just need to kind of say a little silent prayer as we sing this song. Lord, I've fallen down in ministry. Forgive me and help me do better. And you know he will. It may be there are things of a public nature that you've reproached the name of Christ and want to make it right with your brothers and sisters in this church family. It may well be that there are those here this morning that are not Christians. And in the past several weeks and months, we've seen a number of people come to Christ through faith and repentance. baptism, to die with Christ, to have the blood of Jesus wash away sins. And maybe that's been in your heart and mind and you've been thinking about it. We hope this morning that you would join hands and hearts with the rest of us in fellowship with the Lord and work with us in ministry. But most of all, work with us in marching toward heaven, that that can be our home in the afterlife. We can serve you. Would you come as we stand and while we sing?
Brightly beams our Father's mercy from His lighthouse evermore. But to us He gives the keeping.